This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Doctor's Kitchen. Recipes, health, lifestyle.
I had been so used to over the years of being on expedition and being a sniper and always just being connected to the environment. You know, noticing when the leaves are turning, you know, noticing buds on trees after the winter that you know that, you know, we're just about to pop into spring, literally pop, like noticing these things, you know, having that taken away, being outside and interacting with people. So those three things, exercising, being outside and interacting with people, it seemed like were the cornerstones of good mental health.
Welcome to the Doctor's Kitchen podcast. The show about food, lifestyle, medicine, and how to improve your health today. I'm Dr. Rupi, your host. I'm a medical doctor. I study nutrition, and I'm a firm believer in the power of food and lifestyle as medicine. Join me and my expert guests where we discuss the multiple determinants of what allows you to lead your best life. What can we learn that's relatable from a modern day action man? Someone who's trained as a Marine commando and sniper, who runs into active volcanoes, risks his life interviewing Mexican narcos, survived Ebola, and broke the Guinness World Record for rowing across the Atlantic Ocean. Well, as it turns out, quite an incredible amount. Aldo Kane is my guest today, and he is an adventurer, explorer, a fellow at the Royal Geographic Society. He's a producer, author, and TV presenter with a penchant for the world's most dangerous and extreme remote locations. Aldo was recently the on-screen expedition leader for National Geographic's latest flagship feature-length natural history series called One Strange Rock, hosted by none other than Hollywood star Will Smith. And this saw Aldo lead a prominent American scientist deep into one of Africa's most dangerous volcanoes whilst it was erupting. And the description of this in his book, Lessons on the Edge, is absolutely riveting. I highly recommend you listen to that bit. And over the last 7 years, Aldo has worked on many groundbreaking and, as he describes them, fairly tasty TV shows. He's been held at gunpoint, charged by Black Rhino, abseiled into the active volcano multiple times actually, escaped Ebola, and dived on Captain Kidd's pirate ship. And that's just in the last couple of years. Aldo has appeared with other Hollywood A-listers like Tom Hardy, Adrian Brody, and Henry Cavill in some of the most extreme environments on Earth. And today, we talk about so many themes. We talk about mental fitness, compartmentalizing, something I still struggle to pronounce, flow states, consistency over skill as the secret to success, stoicism, and grounding. And a bit of background, if you haven't seen him on one of his many TV shows, Aldo joined the Royal Marine Commandos at the age of just 16. And he went on to become one of the youngest elite commando reconnaissance snipers in the UK Armed Forces, which is no mean feat with the hardest and longest infantry training in the world. He also saw active military service from Northern Ireland to the Middle East and became a survival expert in many environments. And as you'll hear today, he's probably one of the humblest and nicest people I've ever had the pleasure of interviewing. He's calm, collected, jovial, chatty, and altogether grounded, as I would describe it. I could have easily chatted to him for hours, but instead, I recommend you either read or listen to his book that he narrates himself, Lessons from the Edge, that you can find in all good bookstores. It's a fantastic book for Christmas and it is perfect escapism. Just a bit of warning, the language on today's episode is a little bit salty or tasty on this episode, so just take care if any kids are listening in. And remember, check out the doctorskitchen.com newsletter where I share weekly mindset tips, many of which Aldo puts into practice when he's in extreme environments such as breath work and reframing. Onto the pod.
I've had you in my ears the whole week, right? And throughout the week, it kind of feels like I'm listening to like 10 different books in one, because you've had so many life experiences, so many different, you know, parts of the world that you've worked in, you know, different elements of your life and stuff. And the one thing that kind of struck me is you've been able to like curate this incredible life that, by your own admission, that is quite selfish, because you can just do things around the world and stuff, and obviously your priorities are changing now. But the one thing that made me what it made me think about was this quote from Naval Ravikant. I'm not too sure if you're aware of him. He's a tech billionaire in Silicon Valley. He's the founder of AngelList. And he's written this book, which is all about the guide to work and happiness. So it's geared towards people like in the tech industry and people, you know, who work in office jobs. But there's this one thing. It's like, find work that feels like play. And listening to your experiences, it just sounds like you've nailed it. It sounds like you've found like the perfect balance that makes other people see what you do, think like, oh my God, I can never do that. But for you, it's like the most incredible way to live your life. And it feels like you just wake up every single day and you're like, I'm smashing life. Is that fair to say?
My wife wouldn't agree with that. Sometimes she thinks I'm a grumpy old git. But You mentioned it sort of when you first started there, was curated. And, you know, it's hard to say this without sounding arrogant, so that's not the way that I'm trying to come across. But what I'm trying to say is that it's been planned. I have planned it that way. I discovered very early on that life is incredibly fragile and brief. You know, even if we live to 100 years, it's just such a flash in the pan, a speck of you know, it's almost like it doesn't matter. But yet for us, you know, that's such a long period of time, inverted commas. And I think I sort of found out early on that you know, life was incredibly short, but there was hacks to it. And the hacks were, first of all, the biggest life hack that, you know, that I can probably try and communicate is the fact that you can literally be, do, have whatever you want. Now, that sounds ridiculous, but most people, you know, in my experience of talking to them, don't really know what it is that they want. You know, we're so busy, and maybe you do for a bit when you're at university because you have to choose what you want to go and study. And then you come out and then there's all of this decision again and all of these things to do. So I feel lucky that early on I found that passion. You know, that passion for me was adventure, being outside, and, you know, working with other like-minded people and testing myself physically, mentally and emotionally. And I think since I found that and discovered that, everything that I've been doing has been with purpose. And short periods of my life and time that I haven't had purpose has been the times that I've been the most sad and the most lost. And so for me personally, that purpose gives me the drive that pushes me to do all of these things that I do. And maybe that's the biggest thing, you know, if the why isn't big enough, then it's very hard to get out of bed and smash the day.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it sounds like you've had that drive from quite an early part of your life. Like, I mean, maybe we could talk a bit about your upbringing, because it sounds to me that you had like real ambition as a kid. Like you saw that Marine who came into the cafe and you're like, that's exactly what I want to do. Like, and that's, you had that focus. Like how did that come from your parents or certain elements of your early life?
I'm not entirely sure looking back, you know, I kind of just always thought that it's normal and feel like it's normal. And I joined the Marines at 16, and was then in a unit of, let's say 1,000 men who are all high achievers by default. So I found that, you know, it was kind of easy. It was the norm to be an overachiever, in certain respects. It was the norm to just be continually pushing and driving. So I don't know. I'm not entirely sure whether that's nature or nurture on that factor. You know, maybe the seeds were there from just the upbringing that I had, being outside, being in the scouts. Kind of, I don't know that I kind of realized early on that everyone, you know, is just muddling through life. You know, my parents, I remember them sort of losing the plot at me and shouting, and me thinking, that's bizarre, you know, I've just made them lose their temper and they're shouting at me. It doesn't affect me. I literally couldn't care if they screamed at my face or hit me, which they didn't. But, you know, I didn't care because I knew it was a process.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, it was maybe, I don't know if that's a sort of enlightened way of thinking or a stupid way of thinking, but it just kind of made everything very clear to me that if you want something, first of all, you have to know what it is that you want, and then you just work out what the steps are to get there. And at that point, I suppose everything became crystal clear that, you know, there's no black magic, there's no sort of witchcraft in any of it. It was just process and graft. You know what it is that you want to do, and then you work to get it. And you know, and if you don't work hard enough to get that thing, then you obviously don't want it enough. It's not that important to you. So I would say, yeah, a bit of nature and nurture.
Yeah, and you give like talks to kids, and you've had interactions with people, at various transitions of their early life. A lot of people that I come across are confused about what they want. So if somebody was to ask you, maybe then they're teens, you know, how do you get clarity? How do you wade through the confusion of what you really want to do, and instead of getting pulled into what other people are doing, what kind of advice do you give them?
Yeah. It's difficult now, you know, for me to, you know, when I go into school, people want to be influencers, they want to be social media sort of gurus, or they want to be a YouTube influencer. But when you dig down into it and say, well, what value are you going to add? You know, that they don't really know what they want to influence people about.
Mm.
So, you know, that is the clearest example, is how can you have a massive following if you've got nothing to say? You know, if you've got nothing good to say about the subject. So what I sort of tend to say to people at that point is, work out what it is that interests you, or that you value, or that is a big part of your life, and then become an expert in that thing, and everything else will follow. You know, when you find your passion, it's almost a cliche because it's been said for a millennium, but people, you know, more often than not get caught up in the everyday life of, before you know it, you're sort of strung down by a mortgage and kids and a house, and you haven't done all the things that you said you were going to do, when, you know, really it's about understanding what it is that motivates you as a person. Is it money that motivates you? Is it helping other people? And so for me personally, I feel like adding value to someone else's life is helpful, and that's what pushes me. And I've never looked for fame. I've never looked for riches. In fact, when I was chasing that in early days in sort of like business and work, I was A, unhappy, and B, unsuccessful. You know, I didn't make any money doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And I switch into what I'm passionate about. And, you know, before you know it, there's opportunity everywhere. This sort of like the blinkers are off, and you can see these opportunities. But I would say, you know, in a nutshell, people, if they are lost, you know, need to find the thing that they think interests them. And the funny thing that becomes apparent over years is that no matter how much you think money is important and a good motivator, from the positive, it generally isn't. You know, and you know, you only need to speak to bankers or people that are making lots and lots of money, more than you could imagine was feasible, and they're not happy with their life or their lot. So I think it goes back to a lot of the basics of what makes you as a person happy. And then we've got to remember that we live in an exponential age where, you know, the kids that are coming out of school now are having so much choice, so much, you know, you can earn your money by doing a normal job, or you could earn your money by doing something where you don't even need to leave your house or pajamas, and you can make more money than I've ever made, or more money than my dad has ever made doing his job. You know, and so there is so much choice now. But I guess it comes back down to what's important to you, what motivates you. And I always think, you know, if you go out to do something to add value to the community that you're in, or to the country, or to the world, by default, you become successful.
I'm really interested in your opinion on this, right? Because, you know, you're someone who's been to all corners of the world. You've rode across the ocean. You know, you've gone through marine training, sniper training. And we're moving towards a meta world, right? So Facebook is rebranding to Meta, for example. A lot more of us are spending more time on our screens. We're essentially cyborgs, as like Elon Musk has said, because we always have a phone next to us and we have access to the information. It's going to be a very small amount of time before we're actually going to have devices inside us as well. And we're going to be spending less proportion of our time in real life having those genuine experiences. What do you think, now that you have a child, okay, what do you think about the next 10, 20 years, and how do you feel, if you do feel, that you need to protect them from the downside of excess connectivity?
I think this is super interesting, and it's something I don't get to talk about or think in depth enough about, because when I speak to people on a podcast, they want to know about abseiling into volcano. Yeah. You know, like, I don't know, being chased by a rhino or something. Yeah. But, you know, what is interesting is, you know, you travel to 100-odd countries, you see, you know, let's say I'm in the Amazon or I'm in Suriname and I'm paddling down a river, that no one's ever paddled down before, and there's a big blossom tree that's just come into blossom and the flowers are falling down, spiraling down the seeds into the river. You know, like, that is something that is incredibly difficult to recreate, you know, being there. But having said that, you know, the age that we live in now, you said about Facebook talking about the metaverse, we already live in a connected digital world where you and I are in the pub. You know, imagine 15 years ago, 20 years ago, you asked me a question, how far is it across Atlantic? I'm like, no idea. Now I can go, well, it's this far.
Yeah.
You know, I could go to the toilet and be sneaky and pull it up and then come back. And, you know, like, we have all of this information at our hands and at our fingertips. And I think, you know, potentially it's incredibly, incredibly exciting times, you know, and we live in the metaverse anyway. You know, my phone, I can jump into several different worlds in a second. You know, I can email, I can be in Instagram. And I think when people talk about this sort of interconnectedness of the metaverse, it's just the, you know, it's Web3, it's the interconnectedness, the Internet of Things, everything is just seamlessly linked, you know, and it's the same now. You know, I jump in my car, I've got an electric Ford, jump in the car, I don't connect my phone, I don't have to go through all this stuff to make sure it's talking. And, you know, my phone, the last tune that I was listening to comes up, it knows where my home is, it knows how I drive. And, you know, thinking, you know, I was thinking, we were away camping a couple of weeks ago, and Atlas was sat, this was in my van, and he's sat in the front and he's like playing with a gear stick, and I was thinking, he'll probably never be taught to drive.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he'll not need to learn to drive, because at some point, very soon, there will be, is it stage 5 autonomous vehicles? Either way,
yeah.
You know, he'll call a car will come with no one in it, it'll pick him up and it'll take him somewhere else, and that'll be it.
Yeah.
You know, he won't need to drive. And, you know, in a way you think, A lot of people that I speak to in my line of work think, yeah, it's shit. You know, it's really bad. It's wrong. You know, everyone's going to, you know, turn into lazy couch potatoes. Yeah. But I wonder, you know, does getting rid of all the things that we need to do now, does that give us more time to enjoy real environments, to get outside? I'm not sure. And maybe it's just everyone becomes a better or worse version of themselves already.
Yeah.
And maybe the other side is, you know, I can't get to Val d'Isère skiing this week, but I can jump into the metaverse and have a morning of it and then still be in the office in London on, you know, in the afternoon. I don't know what happens when it starts becoming better than real life. That's probably...
That's the scary bit, I think, if it becomes better than real life. Because right now, I guess, you know, there is a degree of separation. Like the fact that we're having a conversation through some pretty good high definition screens is great, but it can't compare to if you were right in front of me and we were like chatting over coffee or a pint or whatever. You know, but when it becomes as good or better, that's where it's like, oh, okay, that's where it becomes a bit scary.
It's already happening. So there is technology now that we can Zoom, but we can be in the same room, and it's, you know, it's in early stages, but it's almost as good as being in the room with you. You know, I can see around you in three dimension, you can see me, and then, you know, and maybe, you know, maybe the pandemic already showed that, is that people either don't want to or don't have to be in city hubs. You know, we can move out to the country, and, you know, maybe we get a surf in the morning, then we're in the meeting in London. It's not time travel, but it's as good as you're going to get.
Yeah.
You know, you can be surfing in the morning and actually sat in what feels like a real office in London, New York, somewhere else by the afternoon, and then you can be back out walking the dog along the beach, you know, that night. Maybe it's just got to do with how people already see life now and what they make use of in their life already.
I'm an internal optimist about this kind of stuff, right? So I see the positives. So yeah, I think you even mentioned it in your book where you've become more of a conservationist throughout your travels because you want to protect everything you've seen, and you live in a bit of you know, you've got two opinions about talking about this stuff in a book versus encouraging people to go out and jump on planes and go and see it for themselves, as you want to, you know, try. And so if we could have experiences where you're the one jumping down a volcano, you're the one like swimming down the Amazon River, and I can experience that and then still have a rich experience of going for a walk through hills close to home in the UK and having that, you know, connection with nature, then that's kind of like the best of both worlds. And also from a living perspective, you know, it means that I don't have to be cooped up in the middle of London breathing all the polluted air. I could live further outside and still attend meetings or still, you know, practice medicine remotely.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, I think I'm the same in a way. It's you know, whether it's positive or negative, you kind of, as a human, we can't change the path of that adventurous path of, you know, exponential growth and continually exploring. You know, we did it with countries, and then we're doing it with space, and then we're doing it with planets. It's interesting. I haven't fully got my head around it yet. I feel positive in that respect. And you know, it seems like, you know, we sort of came from, you know, a hunter-gatherer age, and then we then work out how to grow and farm crops and animals, sort of agricultural. Then we went into industrial, and it seems like the next stage that we're sort of pushing into is, you know, information and, you know, I guess being a fully connected sort of world. And going back to your question with Atlas, I'm excited, but I would like to instill in him that he can still get out and see these places. But, you know, like you say, with encouraging people to travel is going against, you know, this sort of what's happening with the planet, air travel, all of these things that end up being digitized and in the metaverse and in these worlds, someone still has to have that in their head. Like, is it Pixar with Up?
Yeah.
You know, and you see them on top of Angel Falls, you know, and it looks like what it was like up there, and that, you know, there had to be people to go and see that and to have it in their head and then to film it.
Yeah, yeah. That's super exciting. I think, you know, we're in a unique situation where we can... We haven't grown up with devices throughout our... I mean, you're about six years older than me. So when I went to school, I didn't get my first mobile phone until I was like 14 or 15. You didn't have mobile phones throughout your schooling. So you've developed almost like the in real life skills to be able to deal with technology in an appropriate way. Whereas I think right now what we're seeing with children is, you know, they've always had screens in front of them. And I think one of the things that spoke to me in your book is you have this unique ability to visualize and picture yourself and almost compartmentalize as well. And I wonder if that was through your marine training, because I think that will serve people in the future when we have to deal with multiple devices that are grabbing our attention. And is that something that you developed during your training, or is that something you've always had?
Compartmentalizing a situation and dealing with, you know, being calm in chaos, finding comfort in chaos is, you know, it's not taught in a lesson in the Marines per se. They don't say, we're going to teach you, you know, comfort in chaos today. It's, you know, it's not that. But what they do is they train you so much, you know, train hard, fight easy. They train you so much that when a situation unfolds, wherever it is in the world, you're not only ready, but you're ready for the curveball. And I think that's, you know, that's what that compartmentalizing does, is that it allows you breathing space. You know, when the proverbial does hit the fan, it's, you know, a lot of people just get bogged down into, I mean, you know, a lot of people in any situation that might not even be life-threatening will be straight into a sort of denial phase and then deliberate. What do we do now? Don't do anything. Stumble around, not make decisions, and then eventually get to decision-making. Whereas, you know, in the Marines, in the military, and certainly in the expedition life that I lead, you can, another life hack is, you know, you just make a decision straight away. You know, think about all of the options you've got, make a decision. And by doing that, you're compartmentalizing that situation, and you're dealing with it. So even if that is out of your controls, let's say a situation that you get thrown into, bang, Tuesday morning, there you go, you're in this situation. You didn't choose it, it's not of your doing, but you do have the option as to A, how you act, and B, how you think. And, you know, the denial phase in a trauma situation, or the denial phase in a situation that's, I don't know, that could be happening on the tube, for example, or deliberating. All of this is just using up valuable time. Mm. And so for me, it's much more about, and this is true in any life situation, it doesn't need to be extreme, is to just gather the facts, deal with facts, try and remove, it's an important part, emotion, but try and understand where that's coming from, then remove it, deal with facts, often write it down and then make a decision. And more often than not, I find, bear in mind I'm not a psychologist, but I find that is directly transferable from, you know, having to come up with a quick fix in the jungle to a situation that could potentially unravel and someone ends up dead. You know, that's, you know, the same process is available in everyday life to everyone, about things that are keeping them awake at night, financial issues, family issues, relationships. And a lot of it, I think you find, is that you end up being hemmed in by your own imagination, or by, you know, even worse than your own opinion, is someone else's opinion. So yeah, that compartmentalizing a situation and dealing with the facts in that situation, and then making a decision is a liberating process, and it, you know, it allows you to move on regardless of whether that decision was right or wrong. If it was the wrong decision, it opens other doors and other opportunities. But I always feel that gives you control of that situation that you're in.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'll be honest, in the spirit of vulnerability, I really struggle with this. And I'm someone who has meditated most of their life, right? So I was taught how to meditate when I was a teenager before my GCSEs. I come from an Indian background, so my parents taught me that. I meditate before I go to clinic and stuff. I do meditations in the morning. During my 10 minutes of meditation every day, which is kind of a formalized process, I'm not too sure if you do something as formal as that, but I get tons of thoughts in my head. I struggle really hard to really focus my thoughts on even just deep breathing. And there's a bit of the start of the book as well as later on in the book where you're in the middle of your sniper recce, I think, in Iraq, and you go into what sounds and is described like a flow state. Is that something you can still do now? Is that something that is something that you formally practice, or something that just comes quite naturally to you?
I would say that it's not natural. I've never, you know, I've as much as I love to the thought of sitting with the sun rising and just being like in a state of zen and, you know, like doing yoga and breathing and, you know, it's never been formal like that for me, as much as I would love that to be. You know, I've just never been taught.
Mm.
But for me, the sniping part of my early life, it wasn't ever about pulling a trigger or doing anything violent, which is strange. It was much more about being able to connect with the environment that I'm in. And it sounds really cheeseball, but being at one in that environment, understanding that I can move from A to B and be completely self-sufficient and no one will see me, jungle, desert, Arctic, mountains, wherever that is, that supreme confidence of being able to move and operate in those situations. And by default, one, the confidence, and two, the ability or the necessity to control fear. You know, we don't not feel it, but the ability to control fear, internal voices, nagging voices in your head, all of these things that we all suffer from, it's just a much you know, the shooting part of, like, if you're on the range and you're doing shooting practice, you've got two or three things which are incredibly important right at that very space in time in your life to make that shot hit the target, the bullseye. Everything else is noise. So it's focus. You know, I'm not very good at multitasking. I can do five or six things at once, and not all of them will be done very well. But when you focus on one specific task, it is amazing what you can achieve just by focusing on one thing or two things and doing them to the best of your ability. And I suppose that is, you know, that is a state of flow when you come, you know, when you're breathing. And actually, if you break all states of meditation and states of flow back to the basics, it's breath work.
Mm.
And you know, I don't formally practice it, but because I free dive, and because, you know, by free diving, by definition, you need to A, remain calm, and B, you know, you're under the water, there's physiological changes happening to your body, you become in a very natural state of chill. But I also get the same from running, and I get the same from exercising. So if, you know, if I'm being a pain in the backside, my wife will tell me to go for a run. Or like yesterday, I had a sort of big corporate talk to do last night, and I just, the whole morning, just couldn't concentrate on anything. So I just did a very long run, and in the run, I had broken everything down that I needed to be doing in the evening into these chunks. It all just becomes clear. And that is that state of flow, is that state of focus for me. And that's probably my meditation.
Yeah, definitely. Because I think most people's idea of sniper training is quite different from your description of it. I'll be honest, my idea of sniper training was like all about the gear and the gadgets and, you know, the sight, the scope and all that kind of stuff. But your description of it made so much sense. Can you give us a window into how a sniper would operate?
I mean, if you speak to any kids, or up to the age of probably 25, like, they're going to know more about sniper rifles technology than me, because they play Call of Duty, right? So I remember I did a talk at Manchester United a while ago, and, you know, that was the hook that got them interested in listening to me talking, was the fact that, You know, they played Call of Duty and I was a sniper. But yeah, you know, you can spend a lot of time digging into the tech and ballistics and the weapons and the sight systems. But all of that doesn't matter if you, one, can't move from A to B, you know, on your own, unsupported, without being seen when people are looking for you. No, that is, you know, fundamental basics, camouflage and concealment. That is the basics of understanding the environment that you're moving through, to the, you know, to the absolute micro detail of when I'm looking at that branch, you know, the top side of leaves are usually shiny and the underside are dull, and I can see dull and it's on the top. So I'm, you know, it's about seeing and understanding the environment, talking about ground sign, all of these basics, you know, why have the birds stopped? Most people in lockdown became aware of bird calls.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
But because, you know, it's a primary cursor to my day starting in the jungle is chorus, or my day ending in the jungle is the evening chorus. You know, I'm very aware of these things, and you know, they're always there. These signs, these cues are always there, but it's about reading them. So for me, being a sniper was much more about the mental state. So one, I need to be reliant on myself. I need supreme confidence in my abilities, but without the ego, because the ego will get you killed. I need to understand each and every single environment and the nuances of that environment. And so it was much more about that than, you know, the tech. Anyone really, it could be argued, could be taught on a range with a very high powered rifle and all the right bits of kit, could be taught how to shoot and get, you know, the bullet onto the target. Most people, not the same majority of people, could be taught over a week or 2 weeks how to actually stalk, to map read, to understand air photography, you know, so like all of the other bits and pieces. So it was much more about that to me than the tech.
Yeah, I guess there's a parallel with marine training in general, right? Because I think most people will look at the hard feats, like the marching, the climbing, the early starts and all that kind of stuff. But it sounds like it's a lot more about the mental toughness as much as it is the physical toughness, which is why it's so hard to complete that training. And it almost sounds like it's a physical manifestation of training in stoicism. And you mentioned you started reading a lot about Stoics. Did that help you through that process?
I think, you know, the reading that I have done of Stoics and Stoicism has been more of that's what I am. That's how I am.
Mm.
It hasn't, like, I haven't read it and used it as a textbook to say, right, I need to practice this more. You know, I've got shelves of books up there that I have read of things like meditation. I think I'm going to do that and I'm going to do that. But with the, you know, Stoicism, it was more like I understand that because that's the way I am. And I don't know whether being a soldier makes you like that or not. But I find that I use a mix of it. You know, I'm not far from a military machine of, you know, physically fit, you know, unbreakable, and 110% dialed, mentally resilient. You know, that's not the case. And actually, it's not the case for almost everyone that I know that have been elite or special forces. It's very opposite to what someone who sat at home playing Call of Duty thinks a soldier is.
Mm.
You know, there's a big sort of paradox there, I guess. But yeah, you know, that I guess it is Stoicism, but you know, there's a lot of buzzwords that get thrown around now, like resilience and mental fitness, and all of these things are you know, they're all practicable if you understand, A, the benefits of them, and, you know, and also to understand what the opposite number of that is as well, because, you know, by building the walls to keep the world out, does exactly that. You know, it keeps good and bad out. So it's everything's a balancing act, I think.
Yeah, I think a lot of people came to Stoicism over the last couple of years because of the scenarios that we found ourselves in. So where we couldn't change our external environment, but we could change our internal state. I've been reading Stoics for the last few years, and Meditations is one of my favorite books. I kind of listen to it every now and then, just like 20 minutes. And I have that same sort of thought process of like, how I should process this information, or how I should process this situation I find myself in. Whereas I guess one pushback is a lot of people might find it quite hard to practice. It's like, oh, it's good for you because you've had that experience. So how do you bring that relation to people, perhaps, you know, who you're doing a corporate talk with, or kids in schools? Like, how do you make it a lot more relatable to them?
Yeah, I suppose that, you know, it's a huge subject, but an example might be if you asked someone, you know, when, you know, have you ever had road rage, screamed at someone, lost your temper, which, you know, most people have at some point, or something's happened, you know, and you got really angry and you lost your temper, and then you look back on it a week later, a year later, and you're just mortified that you've done that. That is an example of, you know, being able to in the moment think, in the future I'm going to hate the fact that I've, you know, done this. Mm. So just breathe. And actually, we go back to breathing. Everything can be sorted by breathing and distance. You know, time is probably the biggest thing. You know, that there's been some fairly horrendous things done on planet Earth, and over a very short space of time, one generation, two generations, it's almost forgotten. So if that can happen around the world with horrendous big things, you know, we can, in our everyday life, we can take a step, we can pause, we can give it a bit of time and space, and then not react. But Stoicism is one of those things as well, that it doesn't help, again, use my wife as an example, it doesn't help to be stony cold and say, well, this doesn't affect me because I'm Stoic.
Yeah.
I'm sure back in the day, 2000 years ago, Marcus Aurelius would have been affected and lost his temper by certain things.
Absolutely.
I think it's a balance. It's probably about teaching. If I was trying to explain it to kids, would be about effectively you have control over your thoughts and your actions. You know, you can't say that someone forced you to do something, really, and to take ownership of it.
Yeah, I think, you know, we run the risk of sounding puritanical on this, so I'm glad that, you know, you talk about how your wife still thinks you're a git sometimes and tells you to go on a run, because, you know, it's always like a work in progress. Like I still have discussions with my partner where she's like, no, you just need to hear me feel angry rather than try and provide a solution the whole time, or try and tell me that I should be thinking in this way. And like, I get it. Sometimes you just need to like catch yourself. I'm like, okay, we're not, you know, yeah, machines here. We are humans with emotions, and it's all a work in progress.
My wife would definitely agree with that. I mean, it's helpful. It's helpful to a point, but then sometimes, you know, showing your emotion and vulnerability, and, you know, actually more often than not, like yesterday, you know, worried about doing a talk, you know, it comes across in the way that I am and what I'm doing and what I'm saying. And you know, that's exactly, Anna would be the first person that says, go for a run, go and clear your head, do something.
Yeah. And I guess, like, you know, particularly for someone like yourself, people see the trophies of experiences that you've had right up to this point. They just see the highlight reel, but they don't really understand the graft, the constant pushing, you know, the chicken dance that you had to do when you were an energy salespeople. No one sees that, you know, as a foundation to everything that you're pushing yourself to do now, right?
Yeah, it's social media, you know, we all get a glimpse into this, you know, this world, and you put up the best bits and it's edited. And, you know, even writing a book really is edited, you know, to a certain point, you're getting the story out there.
Mm.
from your point of view, and it's, you know, if someone else was to write the book about you who knew you well, would it be the same? Would it be different? I don't know. But yeah, it's, you know, it's taken a long time to get to where I am now. And I certainly would never say that, you know, I'm at the peak of what I'm doing, because I feel like if you're at that point, then you're on the way down. So for me, you know, fundamentally, my job now is looking after television and film crews in extreme, remote, hostile places from a technical level. So I can get a film crew into the canopy of the jungle to film a sort of a primate sequence, or I can get a film crew into a war zone, or into I don't know, a sort of like narco territory, and to do interviews there, or, you know, it can be environmental mountains, or it can be chasing down drug traffickers or tiger traffickers in an investigation. So really, you know, what I'm doing is the, I wouldn't say culmination, but it's like, it's years of all of these different experiences. And what I'm doing now is different to 4 years ago, different to 8 years ago, and different to 4 years in the future. But for me personally, I've always just flexed. And when this stops, or if it stops for whatever reason, then I'll just, you know, I'll just bail into another direction and find something else within my bounds of the passion that drives me. I will look for another opportunity, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it definitely does. And it, you know, someone who's read the book and listened to it as well, it definitely makes sense, because it feels that you've built on your experiences on this foundation that has kept you grounded. On the subject of things that keep you grounded, actually, apart from your wife, it sounds like hoovering does as well. What? Tell me a bit about the hoovering obsession.
I mean, like the old adage in the Marines is join the Marines, clean the world. And you would go somewhere to do an exercise or something, in the accommodation you would move into, the first thing you would do is clean it. So I would say not every Marine's the same as me, but I would venture to suggest that the majority of them are quite OCD, anally clean. But I don't know. It's just like, you know, when I was over in Colombia doing narco work with Foxy, and I come back, you know, like the first thing I do is top to toe the house. You know, I like hoover, you know, and that, you know, that is grounded. Like, I don't have cleaners doing all my stuff. Like, one, because I know that they're not going to do as good a job as me, and two, that's what I do to decompress. You know, I come back and it's just a whirlwind for 2 days of me decompressing and doing all the things where I'm like, I'm gonna clean the house, I'm gonna hoover, I'm gonna do that, and actually what that is me decompressing from the trip. You know, it's probably very classical, if a psychologist was to look at it, of coming back from an intense situation to normality, and also a way of sort of tempering. You know, let's say you're living in the jungle, sort of in a hammock, and you're traveling every day, and it's easy, like that is easy, and then you then come back to everyday life where, you know, you have the big shop, and, you know, you've got to, like, where am I filling up the car? We're going to see this person next week. You know, like, all the normal life stuff is hard. And I get to see that when I'm away, because when you're on expedition, you have, like, basics, food, water, shelter, like old school, what humans really just had to worry about. And then maybe security, protection, you know, if you're, you know, from dinosaurs or from whatever.
Yeah, from narcos.
Yeah, on narcos, yeah. So that's, like, really easy. Some people will think that's hard.
Yeah.
You know, you're on expedition and it's... But actually, it's as easy as life gets, because you have only got to eat, drink, and sleep. Like, you know, you're doing lots of hard things, but, you know, that's the basics. Whereas you come back, and in a way you can see why people are so bound by anxiety and fraught, because everyday life is just hectic.
Yeah.
So when I come back from these trips, you know, then I go into my sort of couple of days of decompression, like doing the house. Anna now knows that it's not because she hasn't been tidying when I've been away. She just knows it's what I do to get my head in order.
That's such an interesting insight, honestly. I've had like a revelation there, because the fact that you describe what most people's lives are as hard compared to the kind of stuff that you do when you're on shoots or traveling or doing expeditions, as you know, that's the easy side of things. Like that's completely different to how I would think about it. And most people, I guess.
Well, expeditions. So I wasn't saying that expeditions are easy.
No, of course not.
But they are. So let's say the expedition is hard physically, right? Mm. As a human being, hard physical graft is kind of what our heritage is, up to a very recent point in time where we didn't need to run after things. Mm. We didn't need to, survival. We are eternally comfortable. You know, when was the last time someone was so cold or so warm or so wet, you know, that they just had to ride it out for 12 hours and think, well, tomorrow the sun will come up, so I'll be fine. Whereas, you know, our lives now are hectic. You know, they are utterly hectic. And I get the fear, like, 2 or 3 days before coming back from a trip, I get the fear because I'm like, I've been off comms now for... In fact, I was just up in the Arctic Circle doing a job, and we were diving under the ice, sort of on the sea ice, and we were up there for 2 months and had no comms, no comms at all, no WhatsApp, no social media, nothing. And then in the last like 2 or 3 days, when the ship's starting to move back down, you start getting sporadic bits of comms and you get your emails, and that's when the sort of like anxiety starts to kick in again, because you're like, oh god, I've got to do that. Then you're into everyday life of, you know, one kid. I've only got one kid now, and I'm just, you know, I'm like, how do people do it with 3, 4, 5 kids, football training, climbing club, weekend stuff, you know, family, friends, money worries, no job, you know, too many jobs.
Yeah,
it's just like, I mean, it's hectic.
Wow.
So I have this like decompression after a trip, and regardless of how hard it is physically, I'm doing the basics of food, water, shelter, hard graft. I then come back into this maelstrom of information, of hecticness, where it's funny.
That's so funny. I wouldn't have thought about that. It sounds like you've got your routine of decompressing. You mentioned at the start that Anna does a lot of the work, obviously, for Atlas. What are your coping mechanisms for regular life then? I didn't think I was going to ask you this question at all. How do you cope, given that, you know, you've got to go and see that person, do the shopping, all that kind of stuff?
I think you know, I'm not an expert at it by far. Yeah. Anna will definitely say, you know, that I can be a complete arse. I think it's coping is about, again, doing the things that matter, you know, like not getting caught up in all the other bollocks that's going on, because the majority of stuff actually is just noise. Like I don't sit down at night and watch television, you know, because I'm almost too busy, up to the point where I'm kind of like, shit, is that the time? It's like 11 o'clock and I'm going to bed, and you know, I've got 10% of what I had on my list to do for that day. So I think a coping mechanism is just to get rid of the noise. We take on a lot of things, you know, like we're active, you know, we're every weekend almost is something on, and we're doing something. And we could say no to a lot of that, but that's the stuff that makes us. It's going away, surfing for the weekend, or climbing, or up to Scotland, you know, like on a whim, you know, like the night before we'll decide that we're going to go and climb Ben Nevis, or, you know, from Bristol. So that can feel hectic, but also I would imagine getting to 60 and, you know, being caught up in just not making these decisions and not making these plans, you would still be as equally busy. They just wouldn't be your plans. In fact, it's like almost like if you don't have a plan, you'll become part of someone else's.
Yeah.
That's probably probably what I mean.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I mean, certainly for me, having plans and structuring my day gives me like hooks that I can be like, okay. And again, it's a way in which I focus and compartmentalize what I need to be focusing on at different periods. That certainly helped me. And you know, it's funny you just mentioned that about like going up to Scotland on a whim. I went, the closest thing I've had to any expedition of yours is going to Edinburgh, a trip that was planned 2 months in advance, grabbing a camper van with my two best mates. And then we drove to like Isle of Skye and we had amazing. Every luxury you can imagine. We had this amazing camper van, had a kitchen in it and a shower. We stayed at campsite. Yeah. We really camped wild a couple of nights, I think. Yeah. And that was tough enough for me, but I felt like the sense of like I'm getting into nature here. And you're probably like rolling your eyes like, who is this London?
Not at all. Because when I lived in London for 4 years, and I, like even the lifestyle that I was having a hectic life on expedition and away a lot, and you know I just loved coming back to London and not doing anything. Yeah. I was living in Tooting. And just, you know, and if you were home for 2 or 3 months, it was very easy to never leave. So I totally get that. But to go back to what you were saying about the routine, you know, that is important to me. And so like I will always, even now with Atlas, if he's, you know, up at 4 or 5, I will still always get into the gym, to the point where I just changed my garage into a gym, because you know I know that training is important for me, and if I don't get to train then I'm going to struggle with everything else in life. So I made it much easier, so I don't need to go to a gym, so I've almost got no excuse to train.
Yeah.
And by making that easier means that I'm making it easier for me to do the things that I know make me function well. So that routine, like if I, you know, my day is busy and it'll be punctuated with a Zoom or a meeting, but I will always try and start it with exercise.
Yeah.
And then I will always try and end the day by taking the dog out. Like that's my, you know, they're my sort of two cues. I know that's when, you know, I can have a beer then.
Yeah.
But that's, you know, when my day's like that. And I realized that when I went into the bunker, which we sort of mentioned earlier. Yeah. So I went into a nuclear bunker for 10 days to do this experiment on circadian rhythm and sleep. But actually, what I tried to do as soon as I went in there was, because I felt it was so important, was to draw a routine up, like scratch it into the walls, you know, my 10 days and then try and break them down as to what I would do.
But before we describe this experiment, can we just remind listeners of why you did this in the first place? What was the experiment trying to demonstrate? Yeah.
Sorry, it was a BBC Horizon experiment called Body Clock, and it was really a sort of deep dive into, I was just a guinea pig.
Yeah.
But it was just a deep dive into sleep. You know, I didn't realize this, you know, because I train fairly hard during the day and I'm knackered by the time I go to bed, so I sleep all the way through until Atlas came. And I didn't realize, you know, sleep was the thing that people really, really struggle with. And I know from years of expedition work and being in the military that sleep deprivation is a killer, not only shortening your life really if you're doing it a lot, but you know it just makes decision making really bad life choices, bad health choices. Like it's just not good for you. You know, I know that bit so much from but I thought that was, you know, it came with the territory of the job. And anyway, it was a Horizon experiment on sleep deprivation, circadian rhythm, and they wanted to see that if you put someone in the dark for 10 days, what happens to their sleep pattern. And no reference to time, no technology, nothing. So it was supposed to be a cave, which would have been, I would have preferred that because it would have been harder.
Of course.
But the cave had radon gas or something in there, it would have been a disaster for me if I'd spent 10 days in there. So we moved it to a nuclear bunker. So nuclear bunker, one story above the ground, three or four down underneath. So I kind of get walked in there. There's a soundproof booth room down there that's enough to get a single bed in. I get walked down, like say on Monday morning, and then they sort of, it's all rigged up in cameras, and then the film crew head outside and lock the doors, and that's it. I'm in there for 10 days on my own.
Oh my God.
So no laptops, no phones, no watch, zero reference to time, and obviously you can't then see the daylight anywhere. And so at that point I kind of realized that I needed to have structure to my, I was going to say day, but you can't call it a day because it's a wake cycle or a sleep cycle, which is then what I called it. So I drew 10 squares on the wall, and each one of those was going to be my day or my wake cycle. And then I'd sort of write in there like exercise. And obviously I don't have time, so it'd be like exercise for an hour.
Did you have like a torch or like a light when you were in there?
Yeah. So the room had like 10 watt bulbs in it or something. So you,
very low. It was
very low light, but that was to allow the cameras to work so that obviously you could see it. So on the film, it looks kind of like it's quite bright, but you have to put a head torch on if you wanted to read something. So it's, and after a while anyway, I found it very difficult to read because my mind was just unraveled and all over the place. So I'd read the same paragraph over and over again. And I know, people go on retreats where they don't talk, and they go on a retreat where they meditate for 10 days or longer. But from what I tell, there's not a lot of people that go into solitary confinement. Because if you're seeing other things, or let's say you're on a no talking retreat for 10 days, but you're outside an environment, I could do that for indefinitely. But when you're in a square box and there's no stimulation sort of visually from your environment, it then becomes quite different. And so the thought process behind it when they asked me if I would do it was that, sure, like I couldn't remember the last time that really I'd been completely off comms from everything. Anna was heading over to Brazil to do a sort of illegal logging film in the Amazon there. And so she was away, and so I wouldn't have had comms with her anyway. And I was like, right, fine, we'll do it. It was everything that I expected it to be, and also everything that I didn't expect it to be.
Wow.
Just sort of like mentally and emotionally, and didn't realize that I was such a people person and needed, I've always been very good at operating on my own, as a sniper, with confidence in my own ability. I don't need other people to work with. For the last 15 years or so, I've been self-employed doing what I do, so I spend a lot of time on my own at home. But I obviously interact with people as much as I can when I can, and to have that taken away was very strange. And this was all before lockdown, so this was 3 years ago I did this.
Right. Yeah. What did you learn about mental fitness and mental nourishment from that experience? Because it sounds like torture. It is a form of torture, I think. What kind of things have you done since that experiment that taught you everything?
So it is used, solitary confinement is proven to cause mental stress and long lasting mental illness in prisoners. So most prisoners that have been in solitary confinement, I can't remember the stats, have mental illness from it, because as a human, we're almost programmed to, this is my take on it, we're programmed to interact with people. We always have been. We're social animals. But you know, the main takeout that I took away from it was, one, I can deal with it. I knew I was getting out in 10 days. I knew that I could deal with it, and I didn't unravel too much by the end of it. So I was I was happy with that respect. But the big things that I took away from it were that I didn't have a cue on, because I'd always just done them, was that without exercising properly daily, without that routine, the exercise formed the sort of cornerstones of, without being outside, and I don't mean just like sat in the room looking outside, but I mean outside, feeling the wind in my face, you know, smelling the air, whatever that type of air is, the stuff that I had been so used to over the years of being on expedition and being a sniper and always just being connected to the environment, you know, noticing when the leaves are turning, you know, noticing buds on trees after the winter that you know that, you know, were just about to pop into spring, literally pop, like noticing these things, you know, having that taken away, being outside and interacting with people. So those three things, exercising, being outside and interacting with people, it seemed like were the cornerstones of good mental health for me, the foundational blocks of good mental health. And by taking one or all of those away, it was amazing how blue I started to feel. And it made me then think, you know, how many people are dealing with anxiety, mental health issues that aren't necessarily giving themselves the best foundation or the best start to then build everything else on top of. And I guess it kind of, you know, fast forward a year and a half, we get thrown as a world into a lockdown situation where people now no longer can have the life they used to have. You know, they're not interacting with people in the same way they were. They took maybe being outside for granted and exercising. But then there's a lot of people who don't do any of those things. You know, I then started to think about, you know, my gran, who died 10, 12 years ago, but she, in the latter years of her life, sat in a flat in Glasgow, didn't see anyone, smoked 40 fags a day. You know, so in a way, also lonely, also not exercising, also not getting outside, also not interacting with people. And so, I mean, these are probably very basic, or a basic understanding of it, and not being a psychologist, you know, it, you know, on a personal level, those are the things that seem to matter for my mental health. And just, you know, I dealt with it in a 10-day period because I had a flight that night to Greenland to do an expedition. So I went from 10 days in a nuclear bunker in the dark on my own to flying to Greenland on the last night for an expedition with Steve Backshaw into 24-hour daylight for the next five weeks on this expedition. But it seems like, you know, from a layman's point of view as a guinea pig, that if I didn't know that I was getting out on day 10, I think I would have unraveled in half the time that it would have taken me, you know, to get to that 10 days. Maybe 3 or 4 days, I would have found it incredibly difficult.
I've got so many questions about it, actually. But just on that note about how we can compare it in a less extreme way to lockdown, I think, you know, pragmatically speaking, at the start of the pandemic, it was certainly the right decision to lock down people because we didn't know what we were dealing with. I remember vividly at the time, I was having messages from friends in America and family members. My sister was in New York, and I actually told her, you need to come back to London because I need to have eyes on you. I work at the local A&E and ITU, so I know that, you know, I can look after you, because we had no idea about the how spreadable this was, the lethality of it, the potential for viral changes. So at that time, it was super scary, and I think it was the right thing to lock down everyone. thereafter, once we'd learned a lot more about the virus, I don't think we've really appreciated the other impacts of locking down people and actually measuring that against the lethality of said virus. And that's not to say that COVID and the mutations aren't super scary and very, very nasty conditions that have impacted, you know, friends and family, as well as colleagues. But we also have to marry everything else up against it, you know, the financial insecurity, the impact on anxiety, the impact on the eating disorders, the other intangibles that we don't really talk about enough. And I think your experience kind of exemplifies just how important mental nourishment is from the perspective of being able to go outside, or even just the unknown of how long a lockdown is going to last for.
I think there's loads to talk about here on this, but, you know, fear of the unknown is one of the biggest anxieties that people have. And it's, you know, it's the old adage, knowledge dispels fear. And it does, you know, monsters under the bed. If you actually got a torch and looked under there, there isn't a monster there, you know. So that knowledge, you know, it dispelling fear and the fear of the unknown. So no one knew what it was that we were dealing with. A couple of years ago, 2014, was in West Africa through the whole of the Ebola epidemic in Liberia and Sierra Leone. And I can tell you that was one of the most traumatic things that I've ever seen is to watch these nations being ripped apart by a virus that, you know, at the time had a mortality rate of high 90s. And it was a big decision to go down there and to make this film with the team. And it was Unseen Enemy. And that film at the very start talks about it almost. I mean, if you get a chance to watch it, it's amazing. CNN Unseen Enemy, it describes a global pandemic breaking out that isn't Ebola, but it's, you know, it effectively talks about what happens with, you know, when COVID sort of struck, and so it's inevitable. It was inevitable, and from what I understand, there'll be plenty more of these viruses. And, you know, as soon as we open up I've seen it firsthand. You open up a logger will open up a route in the jungle to take down, you know, a big tree. They do it kind of almost surgically in some places where they just go for a specific tree, but they'll open up a route and they'll take the tree, they'll take that out. That track is then open for local people going hunting. Wildlife gets in there, animals get in there, dogs usually get in there. Then there's an interaction between the animals that live in the jungle and those domesticated animals or people. So, you know, I think at that time, the CDC guy that I was speaking to in Sierra Leone was saying there'll be two or three of these viruses that transfer over into humans every single year, and it's just a matter of time before one of them does exactly what viruses do and spread well. And so my time in West Africa through the whole of the Ebola outbreak and the time in the bunker kind of gave me real perspective on when I was locked down in my flat in Bristol and I had the internet and I had Zoom and I had my garden to train in and I could be outside in my garden. I was lucky enough to have a garden. We just moved actually from Tooting. We didn't have a garden at there and we moved to Bristol and had a garden. So I kind of had this perspective of, I knew what it was like watching people die on the street and being watching, you know, 50 babies being buried on a day in Sierra Leone to this virus that we had here that to the majority of people didn't seem to affect. And it was just it's very difficult to understand. It still is, you know, it's still difficult to understand. I feel incredibly lucky because I work and have been able to work certainly in the last 8 months, a year. But I just wonder what the implications are to someone who, let's say, just finished university. There are no jobs at the minute. around, and we're still in and out of lockdowns, and there's restrictions. And I just think, you know, is the mental health, you know, is it a mental health crisis that's about to unfold in front of us? And is that a bigger implication? I just always feel like I have to be careful because there's so many people being affected with it in so many different ways. But for the younger generation who aren't mainly affected by the virus if they get it, but there are no jobs, there are no work, you know, they've had a lot of their freedoms taken away, festivals, all the things that we used to take for granted, you know, those golden days, are they gone? Are they gone forever? I don't know.
It's such a nuanced conversation. It's very hard to talk about because there aren't any you know, slogans that you can stand behind. There's not just like open up or end lockdown, you know, and unfortunately, because most of the conversations we're having are on character limited social media platforms, you don't really get to the underbelly of what we need to be talking about, the nuance and all these issues, you know, balancing the lethality of a virus, the impact on mutations, the impact on hospital pressures during winter, with an immune naive population. There's so many issues. And we've talked about it on this podcast, actually, from a number of different angles, through immunology researchers, people suffering with eating disorders, etc. But it's really interesting to have your perspective on that, because it's almost like, you the last few years of experience up until the pandemic hitting was like gearing you up to be the perfect person to have this conversation. Someone who's experienced extreme isolation and an extreme virus, you know?
Well, that was, you know, when we first went into lockdown, I was in South Sudan doing a job, and my wife, she phoned, and she was on the sat phone. She was like, this is all unfolding, you know, like, I don't think people are going to travel. It sounds like the world's shutting down. So sure enough, you know, 3 days later, we're packing up our camp in South Sudan, and we're heading back through Ethiopia, and, you know, and then back to the UK to go into lockdown. And within a very short space of time, I was doing these Zooms with, you know, and podcasts, and people were like, how should people cope? And the one biggest thing, jumping back to how we started this conversation, was routine and discipline. Same for a kid, same for a dog, same for us. Like, we suddenly have all of that taken away. Our normal lives, that's gone. So, like, be preemptive. Don't deliberate. You know, don't be in this denial phase. It's like, this is happening. Right, let's deal with it anyway. Make a decision. Right, fine. You know, kids are up at this time. It sounds probably a lot easier than it is, but like, I exercise from here, you know, I do this from here to here, because, you know, without that, you know, it's like almost every day is Christmas Day, you know, you're in your pajamas, you're sat watching TV, and, you know, it just gets to the point where, you know, you need to be the one that takes control of your life at that point.
Yeah.
You know, while everything else is falling apart in every other way, you still can control that. Give yourself the routine and have the discipline to follow that through. And that was the biggest thing, you know, the fear of the unknown and how long we'd be in this situation. And I always just feel like it's better to take action than be reactive, you know, be proactive in that situation. It's like, well, right, fine. It may be here for a week, 5 days, or a month, or a year. And then sort of write out your... I wrote out a routine. I would write out, you know, I'll be training here, and I'll be doing this here, I'll be doing that there.
I didn't think I was going to have anything that I could say that I do like Aldo Kane, but yeah, the routine definitely. I'm a big stickler for my routine, so as my partner will tell everyone, I wake up pretty early at like 5:15 every day. I have like meditation and gratitude journals, and I exercise every morning. And the thought of me having completed a whole bunch of tasks, including work, before most people have got up is great. And it means that by midday, I've completed most of the things that I need to do. And then I can actually kick my feet up and take the dog out for a walk and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, I love it when I'm working from home that I've got that routine nailed. So, and I didn't think I was going to have something that we share a common bond over. So that's great. Do you remember the... the moment that you left that bunker, like what was that like when you went out and you saw, like, you know, grass and trees and people? And
it was one of the most amazing sort of experiences that I've had, because in lots of ways, from what I was seeing, feeling and smelling at that time, but also from knowing that I'm in this environment the whole time.
Yeah.
I'm lucky in a way that with my job, you know, I get that. You know, when you go into a cave system, for example, for 5-6 days in, you know, Venezuela, when you start coming, so you're in the dark the whole time, but you're doing stuff, you know, you're exploring. And when you come back out, you start to smell like the rotten vegetation. You get that in caves. I was in a cave last week in near Bristol. And when you come out, you can smell the rotten vegetation, you know, you all the stuff that we're fairly used to smelling here. But when I got out of the bunker, because I'd been in lots of caves, I knew that, you know, I would see it, all my senses would come alive. So I was like geeing myself up to remember it. And I can just honestly, it's like the Matrix, you know, because it was a damp cell effectively that I was in the dark. And I just came out, and it was almost like you could smell these, you know, I could smell individual plants and trees. It was in Devon, so it was beautiful, and it was in the middle of summer. The wind, the warm wind on my face, just
wow.
Everything being in like glorious technicolor.
Yeah.
You know, like as if someone had got it on Snapseed and turned the saturation up. You know, for the short amount of time, I only had about an hour and 20 minutes to finish off the interview, do a bit of science sort of monitoring, and then I was on the train and taxi heading back to London to go to Greenland that night. But that bit of time was like utterly amazing.
Mm.
But it's also, in a strange way, looking back, even just because of this conversation, we can have that every day.
Yeah.
You know, you can go and go to a local forest at the park and then just be, close your eyes for 5 seconds and open them and be like, wow.
Yeah.
Which, yeah, enlightened maybe.
Isn't it incredible that we forget just how amazing just every second, every moment is? And it takes that bunker experience to bring that to full life. But you can practice that every single day by just reminding yourself just how incredible each moment is.
Yeah. In, you know, lockdown proved that, where people started to notice the nature in the garden, people slowed down, you know, the dawn chorus, the evening chorus, no planes flying above. You know, but you can exactly like you say, you can go and find these things to do. And this goes back to the very start of our conversation, is that if that was a thing that made you feel better when it happened and you started to notice it, then make a point. Like, you now know that that's something that you want to do. You found that thing, that one of the things that you want to do. So make a point of once a week, once a month, whatever that time scale is, to go and leave your normal place and go and see. The big one is to go and see the sunrise. Like, I, you know, like it's so basic, you know, but can you imagine being, eventually getting your head round thousands of years ago that it might not come back up again, you know, and that was going to be dark forever. And then it comes up. Like, it's such a free, basic thing that I'll try and do it maybe once a month, maybe once every 2 or 3 weeks, is to get all the way through, you know, it's easy through the winter, but through the summer as well.
Yeah.
That's
incredible.
It's amazing.
That's an amazing tip for people to sort of reconnect. I mean, what other, I want to bring our conversation to a nice close here, but what other activities do you recommend people engage in? You know, if they're listening to this and they work in an office, or they work in you know, at home, or they work in hospitals, you know, everyone has their sort of routines in terms of work. But how do we reconnect and actually grasp that appreciation for nature and just how lucky we are?
I think it's I think in the military they use the term adventurous training, because it, you know, going and doing a climb or something hard and arduous is analogous to being at war, right? So you can see the traits in someone by putting them under pressure on a climb or kayaking or something. So, and when you look at social media, it can be quite worrying and scary that there's so much elitism out there in the outdoors, and you know, which is off-putting to most people. But the simple part of it is that anyone can do it. You generally don't need a lot of money to do it. But it's much more about, again, making the decision to do it, because you could get up early one morning, leave your house and just go for a walk before all the noise starts and the hubbub of town wakes up, or do it through the night if it's safe to do it somewhere, or just get on the train and go somewhere that you've never been before. And all of these things, going somewhere you've never been before, seeing things that you've never seen before, can all happen within probably an hour of your house. You know, we get set up in all these like rat runs of the things that we do in the routine of getting to work, and you know, get off the tube two stops early, get on, you know, walk two stops to the next tube that you wouldn't normally get. I used to do that in Tooting, was I would walk, you know, the Northern Line.
Yeah.
And some days, you know, if I didn't have to, you know, any more meetings in the afternoon, I would walk back along the Northern Line, you know, back to where I lived. And I would see places that I would never have normally seen. So I think, again, it's that awareness. It's really easy to do. That's what I sussed coming out of the bunker, that for my mental health and to have a good cornerstone and foundation, it was weird because the things that made the most difference to me were free. You know, all the other trappings that I had and the things I wanted and the nice to haves didn't actually make me happy. What made me happy was interacting with people, exercising and being outside. And actually, whether you, I won't probably go out on a limb here, but I venture to suggest that even if you don't like being outside or exercising or interacting with people, if you did it, you would probably be in a better headspace than you were.
Yeah.
where before it, I don't know. But yeah, that's, I would say just, you know, is get outside.
Yeah.
Get outside.
Yeah. I to go back on a point that you were talking about earlier about how we've evolved, I certainly think we are tribal people that have evolved to live in communities with connection. We share food, we share stories, we, you know, walk together. Our mental meditation practices, walking and stillness and being cognizant of everything that's going on in the environment. The two things that I'm planning to do fairly often. The thing I'm planning to do is doing a foraging course, because I love cooking. Obviously, that's my gig, like writing cookbooks and stuff. But I don't think I know that much about growing and finding stuff in nature, and that will be an excuse to go out in the wild as well. And the second thing I do, for anyone that's living in cities, is I found the best time to get that quiet is Sunday morning. So instead of doing something late on a Saturday night or like going out or whatever, go to bed early, wake up early on Sunday. Honestly, it's like there is no one else in the city, and walk around, go to some of the sites. It's incredible. It is absolutely amazing. So definitely try and do that, because you'll be amazed at how still the city can be.
Yeah, that's super true. And that's not walking back from your Saturday.
No.
But the foraging course as well, that's something that's, you know, once you start to look around and see what's available for eating, just, you know, in your local park or in your local forest, it has that more, gives you that confidence again.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, basics, food, water, shelter.
Yeah. Aldo, I haven't asked you about lions, narcos, abseiling down volcanoes, anything like that. But hopefully you found this conversation enriching anyway. We talked about butterflies and grass and smelling decomposing vegetation. So
yeah, no, I've loved it. It's quite refreshing, because I do end up, you know, talking to lots of people about all the adventurous parts of it. But, you know, that's one part of that. That's what I do. But, you know, there's a whole other side of what I'm interested in. And it's much more about mental well-being, about physical health, and that's everything that we've talked about there has been Bang on.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Definitely. No, thank you. And I think, you know, my sort of role, I guess, as a doctor who likes playing around with vegetables and talking about like mindfulness is to sort of extract the rich experiences that you've had for an audience that probably will never get. I mean, I personally will never get to do some of the amazing things that you've done. Purely because I don't think I've got it in me, but also because I just won't ever get to that point where I'm abseiling down, you know, and looking at lava rivers and stuff. I'm more than happy to watch you do it on TV and feel inspired. But, you know, I think there are things that you've done through your experiences that can enrich the lives of people listening to this. And honestly, the book's fantastic. It's full of wonderful stories. And yeah, I wish you the best with it. It's amazing. What are you going to do next, actually? Where's the next expedition? I'm sure you've got to like run after this and grab a train and go to Heathrow or something. I don't know.
I'm here. I just got back from the Arctic. So I've been home for about a month and I'm not away again until January. So heading over to the States and then down to Ecuador. So I've got a huge amount of time at home.
Amazing. Amazing.
Which is great. Dad.
You get to see Atlas grow. Amazing. Amazing. Good on you, dude.
All right, man. Thank you so much for having me on. Really appreciate that.
No, thank you. Honestly, that was that's brilliant. Thank you so much for listening to today's episode with Aldo Kane. His book is fantastic. You need to go check it out. It is called Lessons on the Edge. And if you go to Aldo's website, he's also got a fitness program that I'm currently doing right now. And yes, it is fairly tasty. So it's definitely not for the faint-hearted, but I'm absolutely loving it right now. So do go check that out. It's only 30 quid or something. And thank you so much for listening in. I will see you here next time.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style. Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.